there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3571 of the Survival Podcast. It is a Wednesday. Today, we're going to talk about one of my favorite things, bacon seeds and growing them into bacon and ham and sausage and all kinds of wonderful things. That actually makes me think of a Simpsons episode where Homer was talking about something like bacon and sausage and, you know, ham and like, Marge is like, hey, Homer, those all come from one animal. And he's like, oh, sure, Marge, a wonderful, magical animal from the land of Narnia. Sometimes pigs can actually seem that way. They're pretty amazing critters as to what they do for us in a standpoint of food. And this fits really well with the episode I did yesterday. Yesterday, we did an episode on the war on meat, which the media assures us doesn't exist. It's all in your head. It's a conspiracy theory. And in every article where they tell you that there's no war on meat, and in the first paragraph, the rest of the article tells you why you shouldn't be eating meat. Well, one of the ways to deal with that is to take on the responsibility for raising our own protein right in our own backyard. So when Kelsey reached out to me and wanted to be on the show, I was like, this is a great subject. And it just so happened, I really planned to stack these two shows together. It just worked out that way because that's how you guys voted yesterday on X, was for the show we did. So I'll bring Kelsey on in just a minute. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our two sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Start 9 Private Servers. How about you take back your digital sovereignty? How about you stop using the cloud? There is no cloud up there, right? We know where that's from, right? Up there. That's not how the cloud works. It's just somebody else's computer that they control. That means they risk leaking your information and they can cut you off from it. Also, every text message you send to anybody is being, you know, intercepted by your government, whatever. But if you can make it all go away and do things like run your own Bitcoin node, run your own Lightning node, run your own private messaging, access your files across an encrypted connection from anywhere in the world and have complete and total control over your data, you can do all that at Start 9 Embassy Servers. Remember, they also do 9% off for members of the Members Support Brigade. Next up today is John Bush with the Freedom Trinity Seminar. And I guess I'm going to show this tab. It reloaded on me to where you can join the webinar room. It's now a like an evergreen product. You can actually watch this webinar anytime that you want at Live Free Academy from John Bush. And you can learn about the things that will help you live outside the system, right in front of the system, like private membership associations and more. Check that out today. There's links for all of this stuff down in the show notes below. And with that, let me bring our special guest on, Kelsey Fernandez. Kelsey, man, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Jack. Been benefiting a lot from your show over the years. So exciting to contribute.
Yeah, I love having shows like this where we bring people on that are out of the audience, out of the community. I think that's pretty unique to us. I think a lot of podcasts are like trying to get some like clickbait name or something, and I don't think that's that valuable. I think we talk about what you can do in your own backyard and bringing people on that are doing it out of the community. I think that is incredibly valuable. So thank you for requesting to come on the show.
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, it's something I want to get on and encourage other people. You know, 3 years ago, I was a full on suburbanite and it made quite a transition from there. And it's totally doable. It's just getting the right information to get started.
Awesome, man. So before we dig into this topic on raising pigs, how'd you get into this world of like preparedness, homesteading? Like, did you grow up with it? You know, go back to like your spacing out in high school, you know, and try to figure out what to do with your life, your professional background. How do you end up here?
Yeah. So I started, I guess I'll start more so college, because that's kind of when things get a little bit more interesting. But born and raised in Southern California, a suburbanite through and through, never connected to my food in any significant way. Outside of maybe stories from like my family, you know, history back when my parents, where they came from, Central America. But when I got to college, I got a degree in philosophy, which I loved. And if you're going to spend time in college, I encourage you to check out the philosophy. I feel like it's one of the last few academic subjects that really help you or can help you with critical thinking. And the traditional route was to go through teaching or to go to law school. And I wasn't interested in those. I stuck out with the restaurant industry that I'd already started in. And through that process, I got introduced to food a little bit more. I also got introduced to the world of wine, which, you know, piqued my interest because a lot of what I learned about wine flew in the face of everything that I had been indoctrinated with about agriculture. You'd find these stories of people, particularly Germany, France, Spain, where they go back many generations and their farming practices are very traditional. The land now has only gotten better. The wine is only improved. They are now renowned across the world for the quality. And the ones that were consistently among the best treated their vineyards and their entire property like one large organism. And so it wasn't this monoculture, it was this polyculture that was making everything better, including the wine. And so you could taste it. And so in that, you know, pursuit of that professional side of things with wine, I stuck it out on the sales side. Restaurants were tough for family life. So I ended up being able to move over to the sales side, where I started to actually teach what I had been taught as far as their certifications in the industry that you can get. So I got a few of those. I got the certifications to teach and spent about 4 or 5 years or so on the sales side with wine. And then have been the last 4 years on, again, still on the wholesale side, but now I do education. So I do a lot of training and development for my company. But again, that was that started the process. Wine was my gateway into some sort of agriculture. And also into food. So coupling that with philosophy, also with getting into, you know, conspiracy realism, as it were, of what's going on with the government, why are things the way that they are, and just trying to challenge those narratives in my head, I started to realize that some of the things that we were using just like on a definition level were wrong or were false or were at least broken. One of those examples came up in 2016 when I got into making my own sourdough bread, and I realized I had never had bread before because everything else that was called bread did not measure up to what this was. And it started out with a gentleman named Chad Robertson of Tartine. He has a great book that kind of helped me get started. And so that just made me question what else is out there, you know, that I'm being fooled about. And that kind of ran up into the 2020s and the tyranny that was unleashed on us there. And I just knew, yes, I'd made myself a successful career in the world as it was, but that I was discovering these more real things. I knew I needed more real skills. And so I started looking to gardening, to raising chickens. At the time we had 3 kids and we were living at my parents' house, again, in suburbia, kind of seeking out a suburban home. But this really started the point where I was shifting and realizing, okay, I needed my home to produce for me. I need to do something where I can teach my kids something a bit more hard, tangible skills. And I myself need to learn them. And then the real turning point was finding a gentleman named Brandon Sheard of Farmstead Meatsmith.
Oh.
You know, full disclosure, like a lot of what I learned and I talk about today, I learned from him. So I won't be crediting him constantly with it, but just know at the beginning, yeah, that he was my major teacher and mentor. And I jumped in. I was in suburbia, had no land, but he was offering this pork traditional family pig class. And I said I needed to learn this no matter what's going to happen with it. And so I kind of just went as a meat eater, with the hope of maybe one day figuring it out. And I took the class so inspired. 13 months later, I found a partner who had a little bit of land, only 0.6 of an acre, and had a little lot in the backyard that we could start with some pigs. And 13 months later, I was processing my own pigs, and that was in beginning of 2023. And so since then, I've processed 12 of my own pigs, including chickens and rabbits. We ended up finding a 1.2 acre homestead that we started the process of doing our own stuff. And so it's been a pretty rapid journey over the last 2 years of diving in a whole cloth, but it's so rewarding. And again, it's been so much more than I ever anticipated getting into, but that's how I ended up here.
That's really cool. And actually it doesn't surprise me that some of the, I guess, soft underbelly of getting conventional ag to think more about like regenerative practices and all is vineyards in the wine industry. And I just kind of had a little bit of an epiphany there when you were talking toward the beginning of that in that space, that one of the problems I've heard with regular agriculture is a tomato farmer in California will tell you, I get paid exactly $0 for flavor. right? So they don't care what that tomato looked like when it's picked. It's going to sell for the same price as long as it's not damaged. It goes in the box and it's red when it gets to the store. They don't give a shit if it tastes like cardboard. If you talk to somebody who I don't know anybody that makes wine for a living that's not passionate about it. I guarantee you that tomato farmer or pepper farmer or lettuce farmer or almond farmer has never pulled out a refractometer in their life and looked at the Brix levels in their product. But the person that makes wine, they do. That's absolutely. Like their whole world is based on the density, the intensity, the character, the grade. Like there's no sommeliers for ketchup, but there's sommeliers for wine. So just like as an aside for people out there that are thinking of like places that you can make the case to the conventional grower, it seems like vineyards would just make a ton of sense.
It does. It's the right demographic, and it's one of the few, again, areas in agriculture where even on a small scale, you can make a good living if you make good product, because yeah. People are used to paying the dollars for it. You know, it's kind of one of my projects right now of again, nailing that customer or lining up with that same customer who gets, you know, what it is. People will pay a lot more money for a single estate wine, and something like single estate meat just doesn't even exist because of our dystopian laws that we have. But nevertheless, it can be done. You know, it's just about getting creative with it.
All right. So now let's get into the pigs. Like you kind of touched on a little bit, but how did you really like decide like pigs are what I'm going to do?
Yes. I'm a pretty meticulous researcher when I'm into something. And when it came to providing food for my family, again, I started out just jumping in with chickens and gardens. But I think by the end of my first season, you know, my garden cost me $800 and I produced only one bitter salad from it. And so it just was not the ROI that I was hoping for. When I looked at chickens, there was obviously a lot of positivity there. We eat them a lot, but as anybody knows who raises them, it's difficult to raise them on high quality feed and get the pounds per dollar that you're hoping for on the investment. With pigs, they were the most compelling because it wasn't as big as a cow. Yes, you're likely to be more dependent on the feed store just because it's not a truly pastured animal in the sense that it can gain 90%+ of its feed from the pasture. And that it could be raised in several different circumstances. So all of those were extremely compelling. Again, there was things there to help inform that decision, you know, whether you have, depending on your situation. So if you have large woodlot, you can do pigs there. If you have pasture, you can do pigs there. If you have a backyard, 0.6 of an acre with an orchard and a pool, and you have a pen, you can do pigs there. And so that was what was, again, exciting for me. It lent itself to, again, a larger harvest and challenging my likes and dislikes. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you look at traditional pig butchery, they use everything. And so learning from the world of wine, like the first really great wines I had, I didn't necessarily like them. They were a little offensive to me, but there was something there that was worth pursuing. And so, you know, that was kind of one thing with the pigs, that if you dare to try everything, you could find this new cuisine, or not new, but you could resurrect this old cuisine that was very delicious. And that was compelling to me just from a restaurant background, falling in love with food quality and the traditional ways that it's been produced. So there was just a lot of rich history there for me with pigs.
Yeah, the old saying, and I think it might be a little bit to the extreme for me anyway, but you could eat everything except the squeal. Right. I like the 95% number a little bit better than the 100% except for the squeal. But there is a point to be made there. There's a lot. If you just look at what's in a grocery store from a standpoint of pork. And I mean, even if you go to like down here, we have these Hispanic grocery stores. Even there, there's a lot of stuff that comes from the pig that's not there. And a lot of it is fantastic. And a lot of it's like, it's not in our stores, but yet if you want it, it's really expensive. Like the kunjali, the bacon basically made from the jowl.
Yeah.
Like that is a unbelievable piece of cured meat. And it's like, we don't even care in this country. I guess that ends up as cushion meat being sold for sausage or whatever.
Yeah. And I guess that's what was sad to me too, was realizing even on a home scale, so many people just throw that away because they're nervous about they're just not used to it. You know, and I was taught directly that methodology, but it's not complicated. It's it's difficult. It takes a lot of work. You're not nearly as efficient as a professional butcher. Like I love to have hearing from Kyle and I think it was Tiffany. She was like a year ago. Yeah. But they're more professionally minded, right? So they're still thinking about cuts from a different. They're thinking about efficiency for time. Yeah. They have to do so many animals a day. And they're thinking about making cuts look a certain way. Yeah. Whereas the other thing for me is a family, we have five kids now and one on the way. And so I'm thinking of, whole roasts, like little small denuded pork chops don't do it for us. Like we need the whole thing. And that was where it was exciting to see if you endeavor to keep it in larger portions as well, you end up trimming a lot less. And so you just don't, you utilize more of the animal as a whole. Whether it be, the cooking process that helps to use that fat or the final product on the table.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're supposed to tell everybody, go out and raise pigs right now. It's the easiest thing in the world. You'll have pig forever. It'll be great. It'll be free. Like raising a dog to eat. It's that easy. But I'm sure there are some things that are not that easy about pigs. What is the most difficult part when it comes to raising pigs?
Funny enough, I think the most difficult part is getting over the myths that are out there, that people think that this is if they're going to raise pigs, it's going to be stinky. It's going to be dangerous. It's going to be difficult for them in some way that they've heard somebody else say anecdotally. Now, I would say this, you ought to do your research, and it's worth spending money on infrastructure and breed, because if you do those things coupled with good husbandry, you will end up with a very dog-like animal. To that end, like for us on our scale, we raise our pigs 30 to 40 feet from the front door. Never really have an issue with smell because we keep them on deep litter. They have all the water and shade that they need, and then they get their food rationed every day. On top of that, they get interaction with us every day and with my kids. And so they're extremely tame, calm. My six-year-old son loves to ride on them. And so there's really not that, super, and we're not talking like coonies or lard pigs per se. Okay. So the one that I kind of have gravitated towards maybe two that I've gravitated towards for docility and yet for meat production are the Gloucestershire Old Spots or GOSs and then the Red Wattles. They both just generally speaking have a gentle temperament. They can put on pounds like a regular production pig, but they're very good family pigs. And so if you look at those kinds of breeds going back, they're not going to be a Hulk and a tank for you, but they're also not going to be, Arnold Schwarzenegger, like roided out and ready to jump at any moment. They will give you a little bit more fat overall. But again, for me and my scale, what I'm doing is a lot of playing around with a lot of those traditional cures. So I savor and look for those fat caps and those extra use of that fat. And we use it in a myriad of different ways. So that's one thing that people kind of think about difficulty is you end up with more fat than you expect on some of these pigs. And a lot of that is just turning a problem into an opportunity. We use the lard for cooking oil. We use it for lotion. We use it for soap making. And then for sausage making. So that's the other thing.
It's like, people like me that don't raise pigs are out buying pork for fat to make deer sausage because the deer doesn't have enough fat, right? So
problem's
the solution.
And I'm not a hunter. I mean, I would love to get into it at some point, but I'm not currently a hunter at hunting. So what I do is I raise rabbits, and that lean meat coupled with the extra fat from the pork is just absolutely delicious. My kids love the rabbit sausage we make. But a lot of that, again, is just the mindset of you can find a pig for your scenario.
Yeah.
And then from there, I guess the only other thing I would say is it is an investment, right? But when you make that investment up front, it pays dividends for the years down the road. So the barrier to entry might feel large, but relative to what you get from it, it's fairly small, especially if you kind of approach it incrementally. My first year, for example, I bought one tool a month to get me to where I needed to go. And then since then I've been, processing pigs without having extra investment since then.
Gotcha. When you talked about these two breeds, I think you said Red Wattle, I think a Spot was the other one. And you talked about how they can put some weight on, but they're not tanks. What is kind of at slaughter weight? What are we looking at? Like, let's say live weight and hanging weight.
Yeah. So, live weight on the Old Spots, it, so a lightweight on a purebred old spot, you're about 250.
Okay.
To maybe a little bit higher. The one that I've been actually really excited about is the hybrid vigor you get from breeding them. My breeder does that I work with. She does also does Berkshires. So I've worked with my favorite so far has been the hybrid of those because then you get the vigor, right? That grows out pretty fast. And so you're getting to 300 pounds after raising them for 4 to 5 months on your land, right? That's 2 months old when you buy them. So about 6 to 7 months total. And you're getting that, you're hitting that 250 range pretty darn easily. Again, there's breeds and then there's breed lines. So depending on the line you get, you might get a little bit of a different results, but I've been impressed with how fast. And then if you ration them and get them grow a little bit longer, but they're rationed, that's what I like about these pigs. They don't go nuts and dig craters everywhere.
Okay.
Because they will still dig. They don't turn into a different animal, but they will not go to the point where they're looking to get out all the time and over test your fencing. So those two live weight about 250 to 275. I've raised a couple that I went to like 7-8 months and they were 300 and one of them was 370. I got pretty darn big.
That's a big pig.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a big pig.
But that's
more work than I want to do almost. I mean, a buddy of mine killed one that was over 500 and he brought me just one back leg. And it took me about as long to butcher that back leg as it does to butcher a whole deer. I was muscling everything out and freaking giant bottom and top round and all. Like, wow. You get up. That's one of the things I like about pigs is, you know, with, like you said, invest in good equipment, but with equipment that makes sense at a homestead scale, you can butcher a 250-pound animal to 300 pounds, and your hanging weight's going to be a portion of that, smaller. Whereas, like, somebody starts doing cattle, even like a Dexter or something, like, you're into needing, like, major heavy-duty equipment or, like, a big front-end loader or something like that to deal with an animal like that, where two guys can pick up a 250-pound animal and put them on the hooks.
Right. Yeah, and I think the other thing to your point there is that the investments you make for a pig of that size, you can use it for goats, you can use it for sheep, you can use it for deer.
Yeah.
So it has multi applications. Whereas when you go to bovine, it's like, you know, cows and bison are the things you can do with that.
Yeah, cows, buffalo, and maybe water buffalo. Like, I mean, there's not much else that requires that level of size. This kind of cow, that cow, that's your diversity. You got Wagyus, you got Angus, you got Longhorn. It's all cow, right? I mean, at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And even like, so simple things like, again, you know, how do you hang them? Like, where do you do that at a homestead scale? Well, you can find a tree branch that'll help you with a pig, or maybe even strong rafters, or you can build. I built my own apparatus and I'm not a handy person, but I just followed some plans I found. And I could build something like that. But what I would need for a cow is just, that's
something. Now, you're making me think. So I've got a steel frame building, shop building, concrete floor, steel frame. And, you know, I hang deer from those rafters all the time. It's not even a thing. It probably would hold a half a side of beef. I don't know that I would do it. And I damn sure wouldn't put up a whole beef on those steel rafters. That would scare the cost of the consequences. I probably wouldn't do that. You say that you use traditional harvesting methods. Can you talk about what that means and how that's a benefit to the homesteader?
Absolutely. So traditional harvesting methods with pork in particular is what's called either a scald and scrape or a torch and wash. And that's where you scrape off all of the hair and the outside scurf or burn it off. And then you clean that pig so it looks, you know, it may have a little bit of a shadow depending on when you got it in the year and when it's processed.
Yeah.
But you get a clean looking pig. What's amazing to me is like raising Berkshires and they're black and then you get done and they're fully pink once you clean
them. Really?
And what is great about that is then you can use the things like the head to get a lot of meals out of. So you can make the guanciale from the cheeks or the jowls. You can make fried pig ears, which I actually first time again had in a restaurant. And so that was inspiring to try it on the homestead scale. You get the trotters or the feet to use. You on a home or with a pig, people approach it like they do a hided animal because or at least butchers do or slaughtermen do because they're super skilled with their knives and they're able to find that it's really not a seam. There's not a seam between skin and fat on a pig. Like when you butcher an animal or slaughter an animal with a hide, like a rabbit, deer, any sort of ruminant, that hide comes off and there's a clear seam between the outside skin and or the pelt and the fell, that outside muscle. There is not that seam on a pig. They have the only seam they might have is between back fat and more fat. And so to be able to get your knife cleanly on that ridge without gouging is extremely difficult for a new person who's not used to this. And I even talked to a few slaughtermen in the area and they say, yeah, it's sad because people get excited about doing it themselves and they go the skinning method. And when they get it back, like, well, you kind of have chunks of bacon, but you don't have the whole slab because your knife just chunked into it. Not to mention all the back fat that you lose as well. So that's one of those where you have to kind of challenge yourself, especially when it comes to using the head, using the feet, utilizing even the skins. But what you end up getting in yield overall and nutrition, you know, eating that nose to tail and all we know is included in those extra cuts. You realize there's a lot there that's left on the table, as it were. And that includes even the organ meats. So that's one thing where, you know, when you do it on the home scale, you, and you look at the traditional way it was consumed, those offal meats, the liver, the kidney, the lung, that's not the lung so much, but the spleen and the heart, were often eaten within that first 3 days. And that's because when it's fresh, it completely is that ferrous, gritty, irony texture and flavor that people are used to having is not non-existent. It still tastes like liver and offal meats, but the texture and the grittiness and that kind of ferrous blood flavor that you get from it are severely, significantly diminished when you have them fresh.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I throw the liver into the sausage. And to me, it actually makes the sausage taste better. And I'm not a huge fan of liver, but it's a huge fat bomb. And it does have a flavor profile that I feel when it's blended with other things is really, really good. Some of the best breakfast sausage I ever made was we slaughtered two guinea hogs up in West Virginia. And I made breakfast sausage and I threw the liver of the smaller one into the whole sausage mass. And people were like, why is this so good? It's like, if I tell you, you won't like it anymore. Right?
So true. If I tell you what it is, I guess the one other thing I would say on the traditional side is when you keep the skin on, you can do a lot of more traditional cures. So whether that's the entire back leg, like jamon or prosciutto, or even the front, the speck on the shoulder, different things like that. And I love those cures because when they're done right, they will last in perpetuity. They do not spoil by definition. You have to like shave them after they get super hard. But you're not worried if your refrigeration goes out because you have pounds and pounds of protein hanging without needing it necessarily.
Gotcha. Your mother is her title, but she says, so I tried the torch and scrape and it was an absolute mess. Can you talk a little bit more about how you do that or maybe how we make it easier? I've seen this done a lot in like New Mexico and traditional societies. And one of the things that makes it easy is there's like six dudes handling one pig and they make a community event out of it because I'm all in on this, but like, you know, I don't raise pigs, but I shoot a few every year at least. They're generally smaller feral pigs. They're from 100 to 200 pounds. I've never shaved or what, and it hurts me when I don't. I can do it well enough. You're not getting bacon off a 100-pound pig anyway. I'm pretty quick at skinning one. It's not much different than a deer to me to skin a pig. But I'd love to do it this way because pig skin's good shit. I mean, let's put it this way. Like, I'll go buy pork belly at the Costco Business Center, and it's actually less expensive skin on than skin off. And I'm like, I don't know what you're smoking, but I want the skin because that crispy skin on roasted pork belly is amazing.
So good.
Can you just talk a little bit about that process and maybe what mitigates it or makes it worth doing versus skinning?
Yeah. So I guess the first thing I would say is the scald and scrape I have a lot more experience with, and it's a bit more – I have it dialed in a bit more. The torch and scrape, it's same concept. What you're trying to do – is get the exact temperature and time to get that outside layer of scurf off. Okay. And that the hard part when you torch is you think you're cooking, and you kind of are. You are cooking just that very thin outside layer. So you get it to a point where it is black, and then you scrape it off, and then you get something like a Scotch-Brite sponge style texture, and hopefully one with a handle, and then you scrape it off, scrape everything down, and that will clean it off all the soot and give you that same exact result as a scald and scrape with maybe a slightly caramelized outer layer of skin. You know, with the scald and scrape, I like that because it works even, again, with smaller animals. It's really convenient because I just use a 55-gallon drum and a burner called the Bayou Classic Burner.
Okay.
That's used like for crawfish boils and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's great because you can totally do it without that. It just, temperature is extremely important and timing is extremely important so that it is.
You figured out like the ultimate scalding temperature? Because like we did chickens and we never had any problem with the plucker working.
Right.
Try to do ducks. And it turned out you needed to be about 25 degrees hotter on your scald. And then the ducks plucked fine. But until you got that higher temperature, like the duck just flipped, you started to feel bad, right?
Watching
the duck flip around and hardly any feathers are coming off.
Yeah. So I think part of that with the ducks, at least, is making sure that the water gets to that layer. And with ducks, they have that extra layer of, you know, feathers that keeps it off. So when I've done ducks, you really have to just junk them back and forth initially to get the water in there. Like you said, the hotter temperature potentially works as well. For pigs, what I aim for is...
With ducks, we did hotter temperature and a couple drops of dish soap. Because it breaks through that oil and gets into the skin, like you're saying. But go ahead on the pig.
Yeah, so the what I've dialed in is about 150 degrees, maybe 149 to 150 for the water temp. And make sure that you're stirring. If you just measure the top and the bottom is at a different temperature, you're going to get a different result. The more meticulous you are about this, the better the result will be. I usually have two thermometers, so I make sure that I double check and calibrate them to get that temperature. And then the reason being is when you dip the pig, you want the water to be about 147, 148 or so.
Yeah.
So that heat displacement at about 149, 150 gives you that desired temperature. And then you do what we call it the pig waltz. So you push the pig back and forth to really make sure the water's circulating everywhere. It's getting underneath the hocks and underneath the tail and all the folds and stuff that develop so that you don't have, you know, really easy parts and then really difficult ones. Generally speaking, like I'm in about 2 to 2.5 minute range total, but I check 90 seconds in and then about every 30 seconds after that of kind of pulling it back up and pulling it back down to check exactly where it's at, looking for that. Like when it's good, I know that I can put my finger on the back and I make a stripe and it makes a perfect clean stripe that comes pretty much right off.
Okay.
You will still end up, even on a perfect scald, you will still end up with a fair amount of hairs that are on there. And so that's where it comes down to having a really good, getting the first step for anybody in any of this is getting good at sharpening and getting a decent set of knives, because that will allow you to go through and clean off whatever hairs did not come off.
Could you kind of do what we do a lot of times with birds where we're like, we'll pluck them, and then the last little bit of feathers, we'll flame those?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. You can totally flame those down and just making sure you get as close to the follicle and maybe even in there if you can.
Yeah, okay. And the other thing, like, mitigates this too, like your mother, interesting handle, but said try torch and scrape, and it was a mess. And I just think about, like, so if I did this either way and I hung it from the oak tree out there in the middle of my yard, it's not a mess. I don't care. It's in the middle of the field. It'll go away. If I did it in my shop, so the location of this particular part of the function may have a lot to do with how you proceed. I don't care if there's pig hair out, is burnt pig hair out in the grass. It'll be gone in a week, and I don't have to do anything. Because when I do deer, I throw down just a bunch of cardboard, and blood and everything falls on the cardboard. I just throw the cardboard in the burn pit, but I can see that. As much as a mess as plucking ducks and chickens is, I can imagine a couple 300-pound pigs. That's a lot of pig hair.
It's a mess. Oh, yeah. If that's the element that's just coming at it from, yes, it is messy. I mean, there's just a lot coming off of that pig. And, you know, you get the hair. It's all over the place. I always try to wear plastic bibs just because to mitigate that a little bit. But still, I mean, things get in there all over the place. Slaughtering and butchery is not a clean process. I mean, what they show you on, you know, people in lab coats and looking like they're in lab coats or chef coats, doing it in a really pristine lighting environment.
Yeah.
That is not what the slaughter looks like.
Ask if somebody else slaughtered it. It's fully bled out. It's been aged already. The meat's bled out and it's hanging in, you know, like 1 degree above freezing. That's why that guy looks like that, right? Because he didn't do the hard part. He's doing the meat breaking down part.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Starting from a completely different starting point.
So you mentioned investing in equipment. Can you talk about some of the key tools that you need to get started doing this?
Sure. Yeah. So the first one is a knife, and a good one at that. And what I mean by good, again, is a little bit different than what I've heard other people talk about out there. I really am approaching this from somebody who is new to it. So finding the easiest barrier to entry was helpful on any of this process. So I use carbon steel knives. They don't look pretty, but they get the job done. The metal is a little bit more brittle, but it can also, that means it can hold an edge. It will less likely bend that edge. It's not as malleable as stainless steel. And so as a more novice or learning sharpener, or knife smith, whatever you'd call it, you get a bit more satisfaction and a bit more longevity out of a blade that you've sharpened that is made from carbon steel. The other thing that I like, so I have two of them to, I don't know if anybody's on the live stream can see, but this one is a classic one from Old Hickory. They also are called Ontario knives, and, they're great knives, and they're awesome because they're low barrier as far as like $20 or so. You can find a new one, $20-$25 online. But the hard part there is you do have that curve, and that is where it gets a little bit more difficult to sharpen because you're sharpening, you know, a little bit at a time. I've gravitated more to these style knives. These are Japanese ones, and they have less of an intense curve. And so from a sharpening perspective, it's just quite a bit easier to get a consistent sharpness across the blade. And that's what I've learned. What matters more than anything in a knife is sharpness. I mean, the definition is a sharp piece of metal. So if you have a dull piece of metal, it is almost not a knife. And so working with sharpness is more important, is a first priority compared to shape. So you'd rather use a sharp knife than whatever shape or scimitar, whatever else you have. So those knives are a great investment. Getting some classic Japanese water stones is pretty easy to start as an investment. And that was one of the first tools I got because, again, that what I love about it is applicable in the kitchen. It's applicable when you're slaughtering chickens, rabbits, whatever else it might be. The other couple things you'll need are a bone saw. I use as far as just a handsaw. I you know, people use Sawzall. I like going at it from a very traditional perspective because I also want to teach my kids the traditional side. Mm-hmm. You want to graduate and use some of the higher end stuff, by all means, go for it. And when I get that investment, get the dollars to invest more, I'll invest in things like an extra, like an automatic winch. That would be awesome. Right now, I just use I can't think of the name of it, but
Gambrel.
I have a Gambrel, but the chain hoist. I just use a manual chain hoist that has a gear on it, so you can do it at a higher level. But that's another somewhere to hang the pig from. Again, I have it on. I think I have it posted on my Instagram, but. There's I built this gantry or gibbet out of just some lumber and some plans that I found from a guy called his name's Jason from Sow the Land, and it was great. I mean, it held my 370-pound pig. I was able to get it upright, and it gives me 16-foot of clearance, so I could even do bigger animals. But you'll need somewhere to hang the pig from. You'll need that chain hoist and a way to lift it up and down. You'll want a gambrel was another one. And this is, I have a big old one here, but I love this gambrel in particular because these hooks swing independent of the frame.
That
makes it so you can go really short on a small animal by getting in this way. It also makes it so that when you pull half the pig off, it doesn't just fall in the ground, the hook stays there. Yeah. So, that's another key one to get is some sort of gambrel. I've seen people fashion them themselves and that's badass. But if you don't, you can find them at meathooks.us is one of the purveyors that I use. So those are really the basic tools. Last thing I would say is the gun. So I treat the gun as a culinary instrument because I'm keeping that head. So I make sure that I don't go to blow a hole in the head, as it were. I'm just trying to get to the brain, and then that way it stuns the pigs, and then I can get the stick in. So I use a 22 Magnum WMR, and I often use hollow points and non-leaded bullets. And so those are all things that make it a little bit more difficult. But again, the yield there that you're able to get is higher. You know, I've missed once and that was tough, super tough to do. But it's kind of it's the responsibility you take on, right? That the potential is obviously there to miss. And once you miss, it's to a degree, I think it's kind of hard to miss again unless something goes completely awry just because you learned your lesson. I split the skull in half so I could see exactly where I was at anatomically speaking. But you're dealing with an animal who moves its head. And so you gotta really calculate where you want to be. You know, the general rule of thumb is about 2.5 to 3 inches above the level of the eyes. And other people talk about making an X between the opposite eye and the base of the opposite ear. And that gives you a general range of where you want to be, you know, right behind that skull. But I like that bullet and that gun because they give me enough power to get in, but almost every time I've split the skull, I've always found the bullet in the brain cavity. So I'm not dealing with shrapnel that gets into the shoulder. I'm not dealing with a bunch of extra unnecessary bloodshot.
Down the neck or something like that, right?
And right.
So
right.
Screwing up your Capricola or whatever, yes. Right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. So I'm really trying to maximize the yield by the gun that I use as opposed to, you know, obviously I'm guaranteeing the kill, but you're not overkilling in that sense.
Yeah.
But with those simple tools and a dining room table, you can do it and get started.
I really need to invest in some sort of gear to raise deer and feral pigs up. Right now, my method, I have a gambrel, so I'm not a complete savage. But I throw a rope over the rafter in the shop, and I tie it to – I have these big picnic tables for the workshop. And then just by myself, I can pull both sides of the picnic until I pull the table back far enough that the animal's high enough to work on. And it works, but it would be it's not like it would be a big investment or anything, you know. It's just – I don't do it that much. When I go down to like South Texas to hunt, the animals come home quartered.
Right.
So it's unnecessary. It's usually like some sort of opportunity or, you know, some redneck hits one in the head with a truck and it's laying on the road down the road. I'll go, even though you're not supposed to, I'll go pick it up because apparently even though it's illegal, nobody cares.
Yeah.
Right? Like, nobody cares. Like the last time I picked up, a cop helped me put it in the truck.
That's awesome.
Right? So that tells you. So if any of my haters are going to rat me out for picking deer up off the road, go ahead. We'll see if anybody cares. Anyway, what are maybe your biggest challenges in the harvesting process?
I would say the first thing is the learning curve, right? There's a learning curve that happens. If you go zero butchery to the full-sided animal, it can feel overwhelming. So I always encourage people, if you can, go to a workshop. That's the best case scenario. You can't find a workshop near you, buy in quarters like you've talked about. It'll save you money. It'll give you practice. And it will give you, because there's, with these kinds of skills, the practice is everything. Like, you can watch a million videos, but until you know what the knife feels like as it goes through that joint, until you know what pressure, how much pressure you need to put on, or how sharp your knives actually are when it comes to the, you know, the ham or the loin of a pig, it can be it's intangible until you've actually done it. So going out and doing it and practicing, and even telling yourself there, you're learning, right? And the best part about this learning experience, you're not just paying money to an institute for, you know, with nothing to gain from it. Not only are you gaining the knowledge, but you have the meat afterwards. And the second thing I would say with regards to having the meat afterwards is, don't fret so much about getting things to look like they do in a butcher shop. The major thing about butchery in particular is just separating muscle groups. If you do that properly and then you cook it properly, it will be delicious, especially since you've raised it on your yard. You've given it the right food and the right life, and therefore, and hopefully a humane and quick slaughter, then you are guaranteed, as it were, to get a higher quality product. The only other thing outside of that would be kind of what you mentioned earlier is help. Like, when you start off with this, I always encourage people going in with people that will be willing to help with that process, because, you know, lifting up a 250-pound pig is not exactly doable. If you don't have a tractor, you don't have the extra infrastructure that would make it easier. Having a few extra bodies, some beers, and, you know, guaranteeing people sausage afterwards for coming and helping you is a great way to bring the community together and to share that load, because it is a fair amount of load. And, you know, evidence to that is the traditional slaughter time in like England and in parts of Europe. It would be an every week thing, house to house. And so every neighbors would get together and they would go slaughter at house A that weekend, eat the fresh opal meats and help them prepare all their stuff. Next weekend would be at house B. And so we just get this really, you know, communal experience of sharing the burden of the process, because, you know, they talk about, I think a few homesteaders have talked about the burden of abundance. And that is a reality when you just have so much fresh meat and so much going on, having that, those extra hands can go a long way in helping you.
The burden of abundance. I'm thinking about that right now. And I'm like, the guy down the road I buy my beef from, like, please don't call me for 4 more weeks. That's all you gotta do. 4 more weeks, because I have no freezer space right now, because, you know, just for the final meal, I have 75 pounds of sausage in one freezer right now.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. So, like, I don't have any space for it. And we got to go pick up two cases of tamales and like, yeah. And once this workshop's over, I got loads of freezer space. And
right.
So that's a good problem to have, but you're right. You can't have like too much at one time. And it's another thing I like about pigs here, because if you decide this year, I don't want too much meat, well, that pig can just graduate 30 days early.
100%.
And just be a little bit smaller and a little bit less yield.
Yeah, it's the beauty of the animal. I mean, there's a million good things to say about them, but to that end, that's the reason why suckling pig all the way to 500-pound boar or sow is considered a great culinary option. And depending on where you are in the year, where you are in time, you can just there's a pretty even curve. And again, that curve kind of maxes at around 350 or so pounds plus, which is why you don't see them going so much bigger. But your ROI on the pounds of meat to age a pig and feed is pretty consistent in those first 6 months, meaning you can slaughter whenever you need to.
Okay, cool. Let's move on from there. Let's talk about, you know, the number that you threw out was about 95% of hanging weight, just to be clear there for people.
Right.
So how do you use the material that a lot of like traditional, maybe is not the right word, more like conventional butchers would discard? What are some of the ways you do that?
So the first thing that was easy for me to get over was, you know, you're looking at the animal and you've raised it, and the high-end organic locally milled feed that I bought went into the snout and feet as much as it went into the pork chops and the belly. And so I just don't want to waste that, right? So therefore I'm more inclined to find ways to use it. So simple things like the scrag end of a belly. A lot of times that people say that gets thrown into sausage, it doesn't always make the best sausage because it's a bit softer and oilier. It doesn't have that texture that you want in like you get from back fat. But slow braising that with in chunks, or even slow roasting it and using it in tacos and dressing it up, it's delicious. It's fantastic. Finding ways to use the trotters, as I mentioned, the feet of the pig. You know, there's a bunch of great peasant cookbooks that I've come across throughout the years, and they go through so many different ways these were eaten. I'm actually in the process right now of making pickled pig's feet, which I found out was a huge bar food for a long period of time, even in America, especially in the South. So I'm excited to try my version of it. But it's to the common person, that's extremely off-putting. But for me, and again, from the homestead scale, I'm like, this is more food without having to spend more money. And I'm just throwing there's no reason to throw it out. If nothing else, to do things like you can take the pork skin. Obviously, you can make chicharrones or pork rinds with it. Another thing I've played around with is making old school jello. And so you just boil out all the gelatin and use that to flavor it however you'd like. Huh. And if you do it right, it barely, you don't really have the taste of pork anymore. It's you're getting down to that almost neutral gelatin with whatever flavor that you're adding to it. and then again, utilizing that gelatin. So particularly with the hocks or with the feet, throwing them in your soup broths. I think I put a video recently on Instagram just to show how jiggly the broth can get when you add a little bit of extra gelatin in the form of one of those, you know, odds and ends. And it's great too to get interaction with other cultures and how they use it, because oftentimes these pieces are a delicacy to them. And so they will have amazing preparations for them that are not, you know, it's not like you need extra equipment or special things. You just need to try it. The first couple times it might not work out exactly how you thought, but be willing to at least try it, because all you have to gain is potential good food. And if nothing else, whatever, throw it to the cats or dogs and they'll still like it. You know, it didn't quite turn out. But utilizing those odds and ends, again, utilizing the fat, especially that back fat, so much of that gets thrown out when you do a skinning version of it versus when you scald and scrape, and just gives you the maximum possible yield. So yeah, all of those are I guess the last thing I hadn't mentioned a lot was the head and all the different ways you can use that. So we mentioned guanciale. Doing whole like roast is one of the coolest things to celebrate the harvest. So having like, if you ask anybody, you know, an association of a pig's head, I mean, it's always with regards to like a royal king, like there's an apple in its mouth. And so it's like this food that was only set for kings is now just thrown out. It's like, well, there's something we're missing there. So doing those whole roasts is pretty awesome, and it's quite the showstopper when you do that. But again, taking the gels off in guanciale, I like doing head cheese. I've also done cabeza tacos, which is just carnitas made from the head. They're rich, they're juicy, they're gelatinous, they're the best greasy taco you'll ever have. But again, a lot of pounds of meat that are sitting there. And then the last thing I, partially because of some of the stuff I learned from you, I make bone char out of whatever's left over.
Okay.
And so it's a great resource for biochar, is taking the bones after they've been boiled and whatever else, and just, you still have carbon there. I found these little mini retorts. I don't have one here, but these little, I don't even know if they're called a retort, but it's just two tomato cans smushed together with a hole in one side. And
okay.
Throwing that in a burn barrel will give you pretty darn good bone char every, when I, you know, when I have a fire going outside. So it's a, try to maximize that use and, you know, use it for thousands of years to build soil structure.
So you come out of a food background to a degree, and people that do that tend to, when I work with them in the kitchen, they almost annoy the shit out of me with their concerns about food safety. Like, like, did you sanitize that fork or whatever? Man, I'm putting this thing in a frying pan that's 250 degrees on the surface temp. It's going to be all right, man. But there are some concerns with food safety, especially when you start processing, because you have, like, how long something is in a certain temperature and stuff like that can be an issue. So how do you manage food safety when you're home processing?
Yeah, so again, I would encourage you to do your research. In the research that I've done, I have found very little reason to freak out about food safety, especially because you're starting out with a healthy animal. Now,
yeah.
If your animal was stressed, fed growth hormones, killed on a concrete floor with tons of other animals, and then run through a process where it's touching many different hands and many different knives and many different surfaces, and then wrapped in an anaerobic environment in plastic,
yeah.
Yes, I would be scared of that item too, for sure. But if you are raising something at home where you're feeding organic feed, it's getting sunshine, it's a healthy, happy animal, you'd be amazed how long the meat can dry age, especially when it's in large cuts. So I don't think that pork, it doesn't necessarily benefit from dry aging the same way that beef and other ruminants do. However, you have a lot less to fear with regards to potential food safety concerns. And you study things like botulism or what's the big parasite? Trichinosis.
Yeah,
and you look at where they come from. Again, you were talking with Kyle. Like, trichinosis really only exists in bears, maybe feral pigs, because the way that it's transmitted from one animal to another is by eating the live flesh of an animal, or rotting flesh of an animal that's already infected.
Yes.
My pigs are not doing that. So I have 0% chance of that being an issue. And again, even if you did go to the sense that it could have happened in your cures or something you're eating raw, like, there was one that was, a recent study that I found on trichinosis where they had a pig that had trichinosis. They cured it in a traditional curing without curing salts, like without the pink salt.
And straight salt.
Right. And they fed it to mice, and they try to see what would happen if the trichinosis would endure the curing process. And there was like 97% of the time it had no issue at all, which if any study tells you that, they're just, the 3% is just the margin of error, right? That they're going to operate, but
yeah.
They had zero issue with it, even in a raw, like, salami version. Now, when you're dealing with salami, that's where you're dealing with ground meat, and that's where you could potentially run into botulism and something that you would want to be a little bit more careful with on sort of temperature and humidity. But with whole muscle cures, so the things like capicolas, the guanciales, the bacon,
yeah.
The legs, you're not introducing any foreign substance into the muscle. The muscle is already sterile, and so as long as you keep it from gaining any sort of holes or fissures where other bad nefarious bacteria could potentially get in, it's really not a problem. Evidence that I have a copa here. Now, if you kind of look, there's mold on it. It's been hanging in my garage, but then you look on the inside and it's, you know, perfect. And that outside, it's kind of like the rind on a cheese. You can cut it off if you really want to, but it has tons of flavor. Most of that mold is penicillin, anyways, or a version of it, which, you know, is likely to help you more than anything than hurt you. So a lot of my research into those two major issues, trichinosis and botulism, have kind of led me to a nothing burger more than anything. That there's been, if you try to find a case of these happening, it's really difficult. And you look at that, what happened in that situation, and you're like, well, you're a dumbass.
Exactly. Yeah. So I looked into this when I got into curing, especially using like factory pork in some of my curing experiments and all. And it turns out if you freeze to 5 degrees Fahrenheit or lower for 30 days, that will also wipe out trichinosis parasites.
Oh, okay.
So that's like if somebody's really, really concerned, But I mean, when it comes to the general concerns that people have, I think what you said is very important. Like, where was that animal slaughtered? How was it slaughtered? And how was it processed? So a lot of these regulations we have, if you went, you probably wouldn't want to eat factory meat ever again if you did. But if you go to a commercial slaughterhouse, you'll see why that exists. You have animals defecating while they're being slaughtered, like, and then things are touching each other. Shouldn't. I worked in a turkey farm, you know, basically scrubbing kill floors as a part-time seasonal worker when I was 16 years old. It was nasty. Where when we shot a deer, and going back, you know, the 1980s here, you shoot a deer, we'd gut it right in the field, take the liver and the heart, throw them in a couple bags, whip that back inside the animal, throw that shit in the back of the truck, and if, yeah, and it was winter, right? So it is cooler weather, but if that was the first deer shot that day, we're not going home.
Right.
You'd be out there all day, and maybe you come home with two or three deer, and then we would hang them up down in our cellar down there. And again, it's cold, but it's not, you know, regulation cold all the time. Oh, that deer might hang down there after being skinned for another day before we quartered it. No one ever died.
No.
No one ever got sick.
No.
Like, I think that what happens is modern safety regulations have a purpose, but they are a product of modern industrial meat processing, right? If you take that away, the things that they do are wholly unnecessary and, in fact, probably do more harm than good. Like, you know, if you've eaten factory chicken or turkey, it's been immersed in basically bleach water. I'm not doing that when I call a duck or a chicken. I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And one convenient result of all of that propaganda is that people get scared of producing their own meat. Yeah. And so it's just, it does take a bit of a mental block to kind of move past that. But, you know, evidence to that, I've tried every one of my animals raw from the get go. So I make it a point to taste my sausage raw, because once I get that flavor where I've dialed in, then I know it's good to go.
Okay.
Never had an issue, right? Because salmonella or any of these other bacterial infections, they manifest by that handling process more than anything. And it's not the animal itself. Like, chicken itself doesn't have salmonella. It's the processing.
It would be sick if it had salmonella, right?
Right. And you would not want to eat it. It'd be putrefying and gross in the muscle structure. But that, even if a sick animal, I've done it before because I just wanted to see what it looked like. The meat looks pristine in even sick animals, because it's not infecting the muscle, right? What's sick is their offal system, or their respiratory or something else that's an issue that's getting impacted. It's not the muscle tissue. And again, I think I have another one here just to kind of, I'm doing experiments on my own just to see how long things can go, but these are just dry aged pork ribs.
Okay.
And they're all not salted, nothing. And they're just, you cut into these and it's amazing to see the fat to meat ratio. Everything's preserved. And I've tried them a few times and they're delicious, and there's no smell, no issue. But those are 6 months old of sitting without salt and refrigeration.
Okay. So are there some traditional curing methods you use, and like, how long do they last, other than just, we're going to leave the ribs sit out on the counter?
So I don't leave them on the counter. I wouldn't go that far, but maybe next season I'll try it out. So what I do is I haven't worked with like the equalization cures that I know a lot of people do. So they get the exact amount of salt, they vacuum seal that in a bag, and that allows you to get, you know, a particular ratio of salt in that curing process. What I go for is the way that I was taught is you throw the meat in a mixture of about 60-40 salt to sugar, and then you let it soak up the salt as much as it will take. So you kind of coat it all there, coat the entire exposed part. You know, for my bacon, it's always skin on, so I kind of rub some salt on the skin, but it's not really absorbing it the same way that the flesh is. And then I stack them in the fridge in a way that any sort of water will drip through so the meat's not sitting in that puddle. After about 5 to 7 days, depending on timeline and just what I'm doing, I take them out, I rinse them off, I refrigerate them in a dry, as much dry as possible, and that's really what matters more, is the humidity than anything else. But cool also helps. And then from there, they get, if I have any other sort of seasoning I want to put on them, I kind of put it on at that point, and then just hang them in the rafters. This is a lot easier to do in the cool time of year, so fall, winter, spring, just because you're not have as much fly pressure. But even in, if you are hanging in warmer months, that's actually one of the reasons why pepper, black pepper as a coating is a thing, is because when you whiz up fresh black peppercorns and coat the meat, the flies pretty much stay off of it. So, you know, you can challenge that. I've had one, what was it? It was one of my legs that had a fly lay eggs on it. So I had to deal with that. But yeah. Other than that, out of all the other cures I've done, I have 3 prosciuttos, like 5 or 6 guanciale still hanging on top of something we've already eaten. And so I kind of go with that, again, extremely traditional method, salt, a little bit of sugar, and then, thyme. And so that first part under refrigeration, the rest of it just hanging in the rafters. I'm looking up here because I'm seeing some of my cures. This is one of actually my prosciutto leg from, this is the one I'll be cutting into soon. It's about 17 months old.
Okay.
And if anybody looking, like, look, this is not a pretty job. This is my first time doing a prosciutto. So it wasn't exactly circular and the perfectly shaped, but I'm certain that as soon as I cut into this, it will be absolutely delicious. And
oh, I bet.
You smell it and it just smells like salami or prosciutto.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I can vouch for the pepper thing. I've had one batch of biltong that I lost to flies.
Mm.
And it was when I was lazy and I used coarse ground black pepper that I didn't coarse ground.
Yeah.
And so you really, if you're using pepper in your cure and you're at all concerned about flies while you're curing and hanging, it's the fresh pepper. And that's why it was used in biltong. Traditional biltong doesn't have Worcestershire, even though like everybody makes it with it now, because when traditional biltong was first being made and it was new biltong, they hadn't invented Worcestershire yet. It didn't exist. Right.
Yeah.
That's my fallback when people tell me I'm supposed to use it. Anton uses it and it's delicious, but it's black pepper, salt, coriander, and apple cider vinegar. That's it. That's the whole thing.
Right.
And that pepper is there, yes, for flavor, but more to keep flies off it. Because in the traditional method, it's done out in the bush. And like the difference between, for an African, South African, the difference between jerky and biltong is, biltong's a thick cut dried in the shade, and jerky is a thin cut dried in the sun.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's pretty much the same. So
they do
the dry season, and that's their cool season. But it doesn't get cold. Like, it's not cold. It's not like here. You know, even here in Texas, it gets down below freezing. It's not cold at all.
Right.
And they just shade dry large chunks, lots of pepper, and that keeps the flies off.
Yeah, and that's what's fun to kind of again research some of this where tradition and history meets flavor. Because sometimes, like you said, it was a means to an end for preservation and then became a style. And so now like peppered bacon is a thing. But, you know, again, sadly to me, the stuff you find in the stores is primarily uncured, meaning that it's just seasoned with salt. Honestly, it's just injected with a salt solution that has a few other things in there as well. It's often either loaded with nitrites or nitrates or using celery salt. I have nothing against nitrates or nitrites. I think that they have their place in time and use. I just noticed that when you cure with them, a lot of the meat tastes the same. And what I like, it's kind of like what I like about wine, that I love the nuance and the different flavors. When I don't use them, the meats taste different. And again, the reasons why I'd be scared enough to use them, I'm no longer scared of anymore.
Okay.
So it's one of those where I just use really good quality sea salt and good quality organic sugar or sugar cane crystals to do.
About the only time I use a curing salt is if I am doing a sausage that I am also going to cold smoke.
Right.
And maybe I'm still a little bit of a holdout of the safety police myself there, but a cold smoke sausage just comes out, I think, more visually attractive because you get that deep red pink color.
Absolutely.
And smoke with it. And I think I do it more for that than safety. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think that when it's about dialing it in, you know, so I think there's some people who are really good at balancing that. And so they get the added value of the safety, but they also get that just that little extra tang that you get from lowering the pH and giving that extra acidity. So, it's that again, that intersection between tradition and flavor, and then again coupling it with a little bit of safety to make sure that you're not working with something that's going to hurt you.
Do these curing methods, do any of them kind of translate? Like we mentioned biltong, and like I describe biltong, if you make it out of a big enough cut, it's like prosciutto made out of beef. It's much faster to cure beef, but are there any other kind of corollaries or analogs that you see?
So the one thing I would say is that the pork lends itself to curing, whereas most ruminants lend themselves to dry aging without necessarily the need of salt. So you don't necessarily get a benefit per se. You can get a different style, and to your point, maybe find something delicious, especially in the realm of sausages. But when it comes to whole muscle cures, you know, I think that the pig kind of stands apart for what it can give you on the curing side. Yeah. The only other thing I would mention is, again, using traditional recipes like rillettes or pâtés even, and mixing in some of those other meats, and then you're combining that with pork fat. And so like in a traditional rillette, for example, you cook it in a lot of fat, you kind of grind or mortar pestle the meat, and then you, after it's cooked, you layer it with extra fat on top. And so that fat cap is preservative. So not only did you cook everything prior in salt, but you preserve it in that, in its own fat or in more pork fat. That will last. It's almost as good. It's about as good as canning-ish, depending on, you know, the canning method you use. You get about 6 months to a year before you have an issue. You know, the other traditional one that's called, in French, it's called confit. And so that's where you take like the whole animal. So for example, like I would use like my rabbit confit, basically simmer it in a tub of pork fat. And then, after it's been heavily salted, and then put that rabbit leg in like a jar or in some sort of pan with other rabbit legs, and then cover
it over it, right?
Right. And there you can leave it in the fridge, and it honestly gets better over that period of time, 6 months to a year. And you can, that's like homestead fast food. You know, you just pull that couple legs out, throw them on the frying pan to heat them up, but it's already seasoned and cooked.
And then you can tell the rabbit starvation people to shut up.
They should be told
to shut up anyway, but they can completely shut up now. It's covered in pig fat. Shut up. There's no rabbit starvation. There's lack of fat. That's what there is. There's lack of fat.
Right.
You need fat and you need protein and you don't need anything else. Like, we might like it, but we don't need it from a macronutrient standpoint. I would say like the other corollary that I think is very similar in curing, but it's much faster, is something called basturma, which is like a Turkish pastrami kind of thing. And like eye of round is like the perfect cut for it. And it's super simple. It's basically salt in the refrigerator for a couple days. And then I can't go through the whole thing, but you make this coating using fenugreek and you hang it, and that's it. And it takes about 10 to 12 days from start till you're done. And it is one of the best things I've ever eaten. But I agree with you. When it comes to like an animal that is like salt in this animal, make things and make lots of things, it is the pig. There's nearly nothing else close.
Yeah. The only other thing that I've encountered that's close-ish is like fat Muscovies, which is hard to do. But I took a guy named Ross McKnight. He has a awesome program where he actually makes foie on a homestead scale. Foie gras. And I took a class with him. He's out of Louisiana, Backwater Farmstead. And anyways, I got a chance to go and learn from him, and seeing the duck breast he was pulling off of a Muscovy, where it was like 25% on the end was a fat cap, and curing that was just, that was like, you know, it's this crazy intersection of duck, pork, and beef flavors that all came together somehow in the cured duck breast. So that was one where I've seen curing work. I've heard also with geese, just because they have that really dense fat, and so you may be able to get away with certain cures on the breasts or cuts of those animals.
All right, so let's go ahead and take some questions here.
Yeah.
Your mother asks, can you speak about a little bit about animal handling dangers involved? I raised a pair of feeders last year and an electric net, and realized how fast and powerful they are. Best practices.
Yeah. So again, that's one element where if you are worried about any sort of safety, you would want to do some research on the breeds you can get your hands on, and it's worth driving a couple hours or more. I drive about 2 hours to go get my pigs, because you're going to get genetics that you can expect behaviors from. The second element to that is, with our family homestead, part of the reason why our pigs are so mellow is because genetics, and then husbandry. So we are out there every single day. They see us. We pet them. My kids, again, ride on top of them. So if you go and get a random homestead pig and you look at Craigslist pig, and it's, you know, pretty wiry, and you look at the mom and dad and they're pretty wiry and skittish, you're likely going to get a pig that's going to be a bit more agitated and potentially be looking to escape and looking to get out, or potentially cause problems. I've used electric fencing. It works fairly well as long as you get it in early enough. I've made the mistake of trying to get due later. And if you're going to do it later, you just have to beef up everything. So you have to have more strands or more netting and higher voltage. But currently I don't even use it. With our pigs, we just use 3 cattle panels that are all held together with T-post clips and then 4 T-posts. And that's enough. And that plus, again, deep bedding. We have a oak tree nearby that this time of year, they're kind of dropping some of the acorns and they're happy with those snacks. Plus the feed that we give them. So
what's your square footage and how many animals?
It's 2 animals. Footage. It's
316.
316 foot. Yeah. So,
oh, okay. So it's a triangle.
I bend it into a circle-ish.
Okay.
Right. And so that they all, and I just bend it on the T-post. And so that gives them, I don't know what the radius would be, it was 16 times 3 minus maybe a couple feet, but that would give you the radius and therefore maybe the general space you need. But 2 pigs, never have them get out. Every once in a while, we'll, like, again, they're so mellow, right around feeding time, I'll open the gate. They do a lap and get all excited, and then they want to come in and eat their food and lay down. And so they have their, just to give evidence to the fact that they're pretty darn happy in what they have.
Okay. And do you move, that's not stationary then? Do you move that around or?
For these pigs, I just leave it. I've had other times where I've tried to move it around. I'm on a hillside, so terrain and fencing get a little tricky.
Gotcha.
I'm looking to play around with that a little bit.
You're saying
more.
You just keep them stacked in deep litter like that?
Correct. So about 2 barrels of wood chips a week or so. The nice thing is, you know, I'm not really urban rural fringe. I'm like a rural island in the middle of suburbia just because we're in Southern California. And so getting chip drop and truckloads of wood chips is no problem.
You probably have some great fertilizer after that's done for a season. And
yeah,
can you talk about that a little bit? Like, what's the end look like? I mean, so if you're taking 6 months, 7 months to grow them out and you're not farrowing yourself, that's another nice thing. You're not doing it year round.
Yes, right. It's seasonal and you can get it done. So it's interesting in California or Southern California are hot climates. I actually recommend people kind of going the opposite. So starting in getting feeders in early fall and then planning slaughter in winter or early spring, because you still get the benefit of slaughtering during cooler temps, which is ideal. Yeah. Starting your cures during cooler temps, but you're not dealing with the summer heat. And one thing that happens with pigs, they need a wallow, so they don't sweat and they don't have another way to release heat the same way that people do or other animals do. So they need that wallow, which is basically a mud bath for them to stay comfortable. The mud bath is often the thing that stinks more than the manure.
Oh, it makes sense.
And so that can be the problem of raising them during the summertime. Like I had planned to put my 2 pigs that I'm doing this weekend, I had planned to put them in the freezer in last weekend of May. But cut my finger when I was doing something and then I sprained my wrist. So I didn't have the dexterity to do it. So I kind of held them over summertime. It still was manageable. I just had to move the wallow. So I just filled it up with wood chips and then I moved it over to the nether spot of there. And that way it helped to keep the front door from smelling.
Yeah, I'm big on the let's do things when it's easy for the animal and easy for the keeper.
Yes.
So I do kind of a similar thing. Like if I'm going to hatch out some birds, I hatch them out really early in the year. They're inside to be brooded for a couple of weeks anyway. By the time they go out, it's not too cold. It's not too hot. By the time it gets hot as hell here, they're not in a tractor anymore. They're free and they can go seek out cool spaces. So it's different, but the same. Like think about what's going to work best for you and what's going to work best for them, because the number one thing that'll kill animals on a homestead is heat. It's not cold.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really young or in like wet, can't get out of wind, things like that, I'm not saying they're completely bulletproof, but in general, heat is what ends up causing you to lose animals.
100%. Yeah. Heat and lack of water. The watering system goes out. Pigs flipped it. And so it's just been, you know, all they have is a wallow. That's when you run afoul of the animals getting hurt. But again, managing that seasonally, you don't really want to be slaughtering in summertime. But that's something else I tell people, is that even if you don't want to get into this and you already have a good slaughterman, you already have, you know, it's pretty reliable. When you have livestock, you inevitably have dead stock. If you don't have a way to process that animal quickly, then you just lose that yield completely. And so to be able to have the setup, like even just with my chickens, I have a cone out and I have my Bayou burner. So if I see some sick chickens or something going wrong, I need to yield them for something. I can quickly dispatch and process them. Similarly with your pigs, goats, sheep, you know, one thing you can be for certain, your slaughterman is not going to be ready at a moment's notice to come down and help you with a sick animal or an injured animal.
Yeah.
So though that's where you may not want to do this forever or every single time, but if you can do it and you know you can do it with practicing a couple times, at least you can not lose out on yield of injured animals.
Yeah, that's definitely valid. I've got a duck right now and there's something not right with her.
Mm-hmm.
She's got her wings out a lot. She seems neurologically messed up a bit.
Right.
And I'm giving her, I don't know what happened. I'm giving her some time. And if she doesn't come around, I'm going to have to process her. It, not even from a need standpoint. I'm not taking one duck to a processor.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm going to process that one. If I decide like I'm going to do a big Drake call and I've got like a dozen of them. Yeah. I'm probably taking them out to Weatherford $4 a piece. They're plucked and they're perfect. Right.
So right.
I think having the ability to do it when it makes sense for you makes a lot of sense.
Right. Right. And again, if you're getting that kind of price and that's pretty sweet. But, you know, for a lot of people, it's like down here and there's like four slaughtermen for the entire Southern California that I know of. And they're always packed and booked and none of them do poultry or smaller animals or, you know, that small of an animal.
Yeah.
You're SOL if you don't have a way to process your animal that gets injured. You know, in between.
Feel free to kick this one if you know nothing about them. Host says, are Hunakuni is great for small scale farming. Anything I need to look out for while raising them, or are they the same as full size?
Yeah, actually, I know the lady who started the Kuni Kuni, I think it's the registration guild here. And so, they're great pigs. They have a different function. So that's just the key thing of understanding what you're getting into. If you have lots of pasture and you have lots of scraps and stuff, those pigs are great because they'll forage and they can generate a lot of diet from that. They grow super slow. They are more docile as a general rule because they're lard pigs. They pretty much just put on lard. But just don't be surprised when you yield that animal or you harvest it, the yield is about 60% fat potentially.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So your chops are going to be mini. Your legs and hams are going to be small. And you're going to have, if you just are doing conventional feed, don't do coonies because that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But if you're able to either one find cross them maybe with, you know, a breed that has a little bit more of a meat production, you might get a little bit more kind of that Idaho pastured pig style where you're still getting decent meat production, even though it's still technically a lard pig. I think again, for me, the Gloucestershire Old Spots crosses therewith or red wattles are great ways to go. If you're looking to get, you're not afraid of a larger animal, you're looking to get that hanging weight of like 250 to 300. You can do that without sacrificing the aggressiveness that might come with some of the other more amped up animals.
Yeah, I kind of like them in American Guinea Hogs. They're great if you have the right environment. So yeah. I was completely opposed to Guinea Hogs. I'm like, this is stupid. It's going to take 18 months to get half the meat. That's not profitable from a money standpoint, but it's also not profitable from an ROI. And then they're still like, well, what is the purpose of this animal and how were they traditionally raised? And they're very much an Appalachian breed, and you know, you have mast fall and they train them like dogs,
right?
And they wait till mast fall when they're going to be right around 18 months, so they let them finish on acorns and they ring a bell and they come home for a little bit of corn every night and you pop them when it's time. And I'm like, oh, okay, but I don't have a giant grove of oak trees for them to finish on, so not for me. But now I get it, and I think that's kind of like, that's one of the things about lots of livestock. Well, which breed? You know, which breed of duck do I want? I don't know. Do you want high feed conversion ratio because you want a lot of eggs?
Mm.
Or do you want a good meat yield? Like those if you want a good meat yield, we're not going to be talking about runner ducks.
Right.
Because there's almost none.
Yeah. Right?
It's almost not worth culling one. You know, but if we're going to be talking about, you know, egg laying, an animal that can go on a quarter pound of feed a day and give you an egg every day, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah. And again, like you talked about too, with, you know, Muscovies, they're one step away from a wild duck, so they will take care of themselves if they need to, versus some of these more, you know, breeding for domesticity, some of these ducks cannot take care of themselves. So you really have to depend on your infrastructure and what you're looking for.
Your mother says, I made guanciale as well, but it was like 90% fat, not sure how to use it as a meat. You want a lot of fat in a guanciale, but that much makes me think that maybe that's a breed issue.
It could be. Yeah, it could be a breed issue. I think traditional guanciale, to me, it sounds like you made it right. It's two stacks of fat with a line in the middle of meat. And again, it's about how is it used traditionally. So you would use it. It's amazing when you kind of lightly fry it and then throw it into soups, because it gives you that bacon crunch, but this oily, fatty texture is amazing. It's also great even fried up as like really thinly sliced and thrown in as like a bacon alternative. Because to me, when I first got into making bacon for at a home level, I was looking for that store bought stuff. And the store bought stuff is, you know, a lot of meat and then a little bit of fat on there, maybe a couple strips of fat in between. I've kind of flipped that now that I've tasted enough. And again, challenging my likes and dislikes. Now I realize my favorite flavor is bacon that is, they call it streaky bacon in England, where it has streaks of meat through it, but a lot of it is fat. And it's about slicing it and cooking it and just kind of the expectation of the flavor you get. The other thing that's great with that kind of guanciale is wrapping it around, when you slice it thinly, wrapping it around other lean meats. So wrapping it around chicken, wrapping it around rabbit. It just gives cooks a lot more moisture into that meat as you cook it into it by just layering it on top. So there's a lot of other potential uses as well, but those are some that kind of off the top of my head.
And I mean, Italian cooking, which is like home ground zero for pigs. Yeah. Like a lot of times guanciale, the rendered fat is used like for like a cacio e pepe or a bolognese. And I'm trying to think, there's one other that's like super popular. That's
carbonara.
Usually that, and so that's a lot of times what they're reaching for is guanciale to make those types of pasta dishes is the fat base.
Yeah, because it's the yield coupling of the oat egg yolk and then which is the protein and then the oil you get from the guanciale, which is the fat, and it's fantastic because that's the sauce, right?
Yeah.
That's
what it is. Exactly. You know, the other thing about the amount of sauce that goes on pasta in Italy, it's not like New Jersey Italian. I'm not big on cars. I tell everybody, you should at some point in your life eat pasta made by a real Italian that makes it the way it's done in Italy with a light sauce and everything fresh and all, just for the experience. How big is the pen? Well, we already did that. It's the pen. And how do you water? And do you use electric? We know the size, and we know that you don't use electric because you don't have to.
Right, right. I mean, again, if I'm looking to use it more in the future, but right now I don't need to. The watering, I just used a retrofitting of a plastic food grade barrel, 55 gallon drum, I think, as well. You take the top off. If you use a skill saw and you can, it gives you like a line that's around the end. Mine were sealed. They didn't have a removable lid. So I was able to take it off. And then if you flip that over, it actually fits pretty well as like a loose lid. And then, just putting a pig nipple waterer in there using a union. I think it's called a union gear or something like that, where it has the plastic on either side and it actually tightens the opposite. And then you can fit in the nipple straight in there. And so, that's great. That one of those barrels could, and one nipple, I think, as they say, it's rated for 5 pigs. So you can do, I do just do 2 at a time because I'm on a smaller scale, but, that's an easy one because you can fill that barrel up and it's good for, 3 days, or so, depending on the heat. And once it gets low enough, if it's hot, I'll dump it and use that as the wallow and then refill it up with fresh water. And it's,
you know, I was saying, do they make their own wallows with it? I've tried using the little nipples and shit with ducks, and ducks are smart. They figure it out fast. They're like, if I keep fucking with this, more water will come out. So I gave up on that with them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. If you, depending on the setup. So right now I have it so that they're disincentivized to sit there and do it because it doesn't give them the wallow they want. And then two, it's not as much pressure. So if you're using like a hose system, and the person I used to work with where they had a hose going into it, that first amount of pressure, that excites them if they're smart enough. And so then they're just hitting that thing constantly, and they will they will be knee deep in mud in no time.
Okay. Can you touch on feed and diet for pigs and what can be grown to feed them? Thank you.
Yeah, so with pigs, again, they're omnivores. They're not pasture animals per se. There's certain breeds, we mentioned the Coonies and the guinea hogs, that are a bit more adept at getting some of their diet or more of their diet from the pasture. But they will need feed, and so that's just one reality. I mean, again, there's people out there trying to work towards that, but it would take – you would not be able to take a modern breed and then try to feed it only forage. That's just – that animal will struggle. It won't give you the weight gain and the time you allot for it. But if you are trying to supplement, yes, that's great. I think, you know, I learned a lot. I think it was, is it Sean Mills? He's one of the, he talks about the plants and stuff you can use for animals. So I'm growing mulberry in particular for that because it has such a high protein ratio. I know buckwheat is really good for them. They also love corn. So depending on your size of your lot and what you're working with, a lot of those high protein or high oil producing trees are great. Also, as you mentioned, mast trees, so any nuts or acorns that drop off trees that do really well for finishing the pigs or just giving you an extra feed source. Otherwise, the main thing I just say is whenever possible, don't skimp on your feed. It'll give you an overall a little bit higher cost per pound, but it is noticeable in pigs more than anything else because of how dependent they are on feed. The quality of feed translates significantly to their final product.
And I will say, like, the most expensive pork on the planet is acorn finished in Spain, right?
Yeah.
So now the thing about acorns, all the acorns are not equal. And like a white oak, highly palatable, low tannin acorn is what they really love. But there's a lot of those in the suburbs. And like when we were raised in them in West Virginia, one of the farm partners, he had a residential home down in North Carolina, and he would bring in like 80-gallon contractor bags of acorns to finish the pigs with. And I'm like, Kevin, how long does it take you? He goes, 15 minutes a bag.
Wow.
Because when you got big mature oaks and they're dropping and the friggin' acorns are like the size of a big shooter marble or something, right?
That's gold.
Like, yeah, he just rake them up and shovel them in with a snow shovel. That's how thick the acorns were on his property. So if you have a friend in the suburbs that has big oak trees and doesn't like all those marble sized acorns around, man.
Yeah.
I'd go in on that.
It's definitely on my to-do list to figure out who we have some big mature oaks in the area. And so I need to figure out who on the city side is responsible for cleaning those up because this is only our first year. It was a year in September that since moving here. So hopefully this next year around, I'm going to find somebody who can just,
well, it'd be great. You know, they have those leaf vacuums. If they had one of those without the grinder in it, it was just sucked, right? Just suck the acorns off. It'd be great.
Yeah. It'd be
I don't know that we can really answer this for you because it has a lot to do with where you got your bacon from. But he says he left bacon out overnight. Is it still good? Odds are, yeah.
Yeah. Again, if it's truly cured, that would be my first thing. If you look at the package and it says uncured, that's not cured bacon. But the other thing I would say to this is that our noses are built to tell us what is good and not good. The only exception to that is botulism, which again, you're not dealing with that in this situation. If you smell it and it smells fine, then you're good to go.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and wrap up here. Hey man, I really appreciate you being with us today. It's been a great, discussion and I hope it'll give people the impetus to think about trying this at home. And you got any final thoughts for folks?
Yeah, thanks again for having me on. And final thoughts would just be to try it. Again, start somewhere, get a knife set with a sharpening just to make even the kitchen easier, and then slowly and surely graduate to that. The last thing I would say is just finding workshops. I know that there's like three or I do them here out in the West Coast. So if you're following me, I think Jack has my Instagram. I advertise when they're coming. But I know that Farmstead Meatsmith does them, guys from Hand Hewn Farm do them, and they're kind of situated throughout the country. So if you're interested, I cannot recommend those classes highly enough, especially if you're coming from a low level of experience, but even at a high level of experience, what you learn there so rewarding and extremely invaluable. So get yourself at a workshop, get started with some good knives and go from there.
Well, hey, I really appreciate you. And, you know, you'd mentioned Brandon Sheard, and I will let people know there is actually at least one, if not two, episodes of this podcast that he was on. And, you know, you're mentioning his workshops and all. If you can go, that's one of the guys you really can learn from. He's pretty spot on. And as far as your Instagram, I have your Instagram and your Facebook, and I'll make sure those are both in the show notes for people. Right down in the video notes below, if you're watching the video live or later, there'll be a link that'll take you over to the audio version. You can get all the resources for the show today there. Unless it's live right now and you click it right now, we're not done yet, so it won't be there yet. But anyway, Kelsey, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Jack.
All right, real quick, there's a last question here. It says, will pigs eat comfrey? Most will. That's going to be another function of what breed. But I will tell you that in Lawrence, I can't think of this, Lawrence, I want to, Welk is not the right person. That's who my grandmother listened to. Lawrence D. Something, that wrote two of the seminal books on comfrey, they experimented with it as livestock feed, and it made pigs healthier up until it started making up like 30% of their diet, and then it actually started to kill them. So I wouldn't worry about that if you're in pasture that has comfrey in it, but if you're going to start actually making a feed mix for pigs and you're going to include comfrey, keep that mix in probably the 10-15% range at the highest. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and remind you guys, if you like the show and the work that we do and you want to help us out, you can do that one way by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day is the Mr. Heater Portable Big Buddy Propane Heater. This thing has saved my butt a bunch of times with power outages and such. I really recommend you have a backup heating solution, and this is one of the best. And when I shared it on social media today, I said right now it's in stock and it's on sale, and it's on sale significantly knocked down, like $35 off the retail price. And what I said was, so if you don't have a backup heating source, buy one now. Don't be emailing me 2.5 months from now when you're freezing your ass off and everything's out of stock and asking me what to do about it. The time to get your backup heating systems in place is fall, not winter, when you already needed them there. So that's why this came around today, for two reasons. One, it's that time to look forward to winter and say, these are the things I'm still lacking in. And remember, if you have one backup solution, two is one and one is none. The other reason is because I got a price alert on it and they knocked it down. And I guarantee you, in a month from now, it ain't going to be on sale if it's even in stock. So get one of these or something like it soon if you are heading into winter and you're not prepared as well as you could be anyway. And next up today, real quick, I want to remind you guys about the Member Support Brigade. If you join the Member Support Brigade, you'll effectively be paying about 18 cents an episode for the show, and you'll get a bunch of really great stuff, but one of the big things you'll get are discounts. This is the back office, if you're on the screen right now, and all the companies that do discounts right now for Member Support Brigade. If you'll make the effort whenever you're going to buy something to check and see if it's available from a partner and use the discounts, it is inconceivable to me, just like the 80s movie, it's inconceivable that you would not get your money back and then some. Just from one of the vendors myself, we use a lot of cannabis product and Acura Botanicals. We make, you know, if I was buying my own product, I'd make all my money back, sometimes on a single order. Both our sponsors today have different programs for MSB members, et cetera. So check it out. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on members to learn more. With that, tomorrow we will have an expert council Q&A show for the week, so no live stream. Friday flashback, but we are back to regularly scheduled programming, and that means next week we'll do her all over again. Take care, guys, and I will again catch you tomorrow with that expert council show. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.